Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Got the exact right message, and it's being responded. The response is fabulous around the country.
Deeply honored, and I want to thank you for keeping your commitment to the American workers.
My hat's off to you for taking that stand and for sending a clear message around the world.
It's a privilege to serve.
I can't thank you enough for the privilege that you've given me and the leadership that you've shown.
So I'm thrilled to have a chance to help you live up to your campaign promises.
Thank you for getting this country moving.
Optimism from small businesses higher than it's been in about 16 years.
We thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda.
We're making tremendous progress.
I want to congratulate you on the men and women you've placed around this table. The holistic team of Working for America is making results in each and every area.
What does it say about someone who needs that so badly? You have to imagine President Biden's first cabinet meeting today will look a little different from the previous administrations. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Thursday, April 1st. Joe has the morning off. Along with Willie and me, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire. And we are following a lot of stories this morning, including a number of developments with the dramatic third day of testimony in the trial of former police officer who was accused of killing George Floyd as a juror becomes ill and a witness breaks down on the stand. Some shipments of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccines get delayed after a mix-up at a U.S. factory. President Biden visits the Steel City to unveil his massive jobs and infrastructure plan. And more Georgia-based companies are standing up against the state's newly signed election law, with President Biden saying he would support Major League Baseball pulling this year's All-Star game from Atlanta. Wow, Willie.
Yeah, and big corporate pressure from the biggest companies in Atlanta, some of the biggest companies in the world as well. We'll get to that in just a minute. But let's begin with the latest on the investigation of possible sex trafficking by Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida. The New York Times was first to report federal investigators are looking into whether Gaetz had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl and whether he paid for her to travel with him across state lines. When asked about the allegation Tuesday night, the congressman, who denies any relationship with a 17-year-old, said he did nothing wrong, claimed it was part of an effort to extort him and his family. Law enforcement officials now tell NBC News the sex trafficking investigation into Congressman Gaetz and the extortion allegations made by Gaetz are two separate investigations. There also is new information on the investigation that put Congressman Gaetz on the radar of the Justice Department. Federal officials telling NBC News the investigation into the congressman began last year when an associate, former Seminole County, Florida tax collector Joel Greenberg, was indicted on charges tied to his alleged harassment of a political opponent. Officials say Greenberg, pictured here with Gaetz and Roger Stone in 2017, misused his position as tax collector to create fake IDs for himself. That investigation led to a second superseding indictment alleging that he used the Florida Motor Vehicle Database to obtain information on individuals with whom he was engaged in, quote, sugar daddy type relationships. So it is out of that investigation, officials tell NBC News, authorities developed a lead that led them to investigate whether Gaetz was involved with sex trafficking an underage girl. Greenberg's attorney released a statement saying, quote, right now, we're preparing for the upcoming trial date in June. Joel maintains his innocence and has previously pleaded not guilty. A lot to suss through there. Let's bring in national correspondent at Politico, Betsy Woodruff Swan, and professor in law at Georgetown University, Paul Butler. He is an MSNBC legal analyst. Good morning to you both. So, Betsy, I understand you talked to Matt Gaetz' father, a prominent political figure in the state of Florida. Help us separate out what's going on here, because there seems to be this claim of an extortion plot from the Gaetzes that goes in parallel and separate from this other investigation from the Justice Department into possible sex trafficking that spun out of the investigation into Joel Greenberg.
Right. My colleague, Matt Dixon, who's been covering Tallahassee very closely for a long time, had a detailed conversation with John Gates, Matt Gates' father, yesterday. John is very wealthy, a former longtime sort of consummate insider Tallahassee politician. And in a detailed interview, he told us on the record that he's worn a wire multiple times as part of an effort to try to help the FBI investigate what he and his son purport to be an extortion plot targeted at their family. The important thing for people to remember here, who may be getting a little lost by the very soap opera-y threads that seem to be unfolding, is that it's possible all the allegations that have been laid out, both by Matt Gates, by his father John Gates, and reportedly which the FBI is investigating, could be correct. Matt and his father say that there was an effort spent to pressure them to pay $25 million to help with the rescue of Bob Levinson. Now, Bob Levinson is a man who was a hostage. He was taken hostage by the Iranian government. He's a U.S. citizen. He's widely reported to have passed away, to have been passed away for quite some time. But despite that, the Gateses say that they were pressured to put up $25 million to try to help to fund his rescue from Iran. And they say that the offer was pay up this $25 million and it will make you an American hero. It will make the Biden administration delighted with you. It will fix your reputational problems. And then, problem solved, this whole FBI problem will go away. Now, Matt Gaetz and his father say that that was an extortion plot, that that's the real story, that the investigations involving Joel Greenberg and potential allegations into the congressman himself are specious. And people need to be focusing on the extortion allegations that they're making instead. Of course, critics of the Gates family say that this is a distraction. And the important thing for viewers to remember is that it's possible there's more than one cohort of, shall we say, questionable folks involved in this increasingly lurid Florida political saga.
Betsy, explain sort of the interesting nuances of the Bill Barr angle of this, because this started under his time serving as Attorney General.
That's right. What I can tell you is that then Attorney General Bill Barr was briefed multiple times on the Gates investigation starting in summer 2020. Early in 2020, he sent down a memo requiring that senior DOJ leadership receive briefings on any investigation into anyone running for federal office. So he received those briefings, and it actually created a slightly uncomfortable moment for senior leadership at DOJ. What I'm told is that Barr was scheduled to attend a meet and greet with Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee last summer. But when Matt Gaetz RSVP'd for the event, Barr had to abruptly cancel because he didn't want to be in a situation where he was having a private meeting with someone who was under investigation simultaneously by the FBI. And that raises the very awkward specter of a member of the congressional committee that's responsible for funding and overseeing the FBI simultaneously, according to these reports, being under investigation by that same law enforcement agency.
So Paul Butler, we should underline that Congressman Gates has been charged with anything, denies any involvement with this 17-year-old. But as a prosecutor, as you're looking at this sort of stew of elements that go into the story, these different people and an extortion plot and Robert Levinson in Iran, where is your focus and where do you see the legal exposure for Congressman Gates?
So, Willie, there are three investigations going on right now. It's a federal crime to induce a minor to travel over state lines for sex in exchange for money. That's what Gates is being investigated for, violating the federal sexual trafficking laws. And then we have this extortion investigation, someone allegedly trying to extort Gates and his family to make the Justice Department investigation go away. Betsy is absolutely right. Both things can be true. Gates can be the perpetrator of one crime and the victim of another. But Gates has to be especially worried about this third investigation of Joel Greenberg. That's the Florida official and good friend of Gates who has already been indicted for child sex trafficking. And Greenberg violated his bail So he's locked up right now, pending his trial in June. So, Willie, he has a lot of incentive to cooperate in an investigation of Gates. So in that investigation of Gates, if I'm a federal prosecutor, I'm trying to talk to Joel Greenberg to see if he wants to make a deal.
All right, Betsy Woodruff Swan, thank you so much for your reporting. Welcome back to the airwaves. It's good to see you. Let's move on now to the trial of Derek Chauvin, the bystander who told George Floyd to comply with police, broke down on the stand while testifying during video replay of Floyd calling for his mother shortly before he died.
Mr. McGunn, do you need a minute? I know that this is difficult. Can you just explain sort of what you're feeling in this moment?
I feel helpless. I don't have a mama either, and I just stand him.
Charles McMillan, the state's 11th witness, also confronted then-Officer Chauvin after the incident, saying he should have taken his knee off Floyd's neck. Chauvin is heard on body cam video defending himself.
That's one person's opinion.
We gotta control this guy
because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, and I thought he didn't get in the car.
Looks like he's probably on something.
Earlier in the day, prosecutors played a security camera footage of Floyd inside the Cup Foods buying cigarettes with the allegedly counterfeit $20 bill and circled the face of Christopher Martin, the 19-year-old clerk who made the sale. Prosecutors then showed Martin outside among the crowd of bystanders with his hands on his head, appearing distressed, and asked for his thoughts at the time.
We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct?
Correct.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
The prosecution also introduced body cam footage of Floyd's arrest from Chauvin and the officers with him that day. Floyd could be heard pleading not to be shot as he's taken from his car. He is later seen being seated by police to await the arrival of additional officers, including Chauvin. Live streaming of the trial resumes today at 9:30 Central Time. Paul Butler, a couple of things I noticed yesterday. I mean, for example, the 19-year-old clerk who sold him the cigarettes, noticing that $20 bill may not be right. Those employees have to pay if they accept a counterfeit bill. So they end up, it ends up being taken out of their paycheck. So the kid was thinking as he's watching George Floyd get killed on the street that he's responsible. That's, he's walking around. All of the witnesses yesterday had such guilt about not being able to do more. And I guess the question is, how is it that seeing this happen with your own eyes in front of you is a different experience than being the cop on the back of the dying man?
That's a great question, Mika. I wish I had a great answer. Every witness has expressed remorse and a survivor's guilt. We saw Mr. Williams, the MMA dude, big booming voice, but just break down and cry. Mr. McMillan, the older gentleman, who testified yesterday, the uncontrollable sobbing. Mika, one of the bystanders in the crowd says to Officer Chauvin, "Why are you doing this? He's human, bro." But the prosecutors want the jurors to understand Chauvin did not treat Mr. Floyd like a human being. All of these bystanders, all of these witnesses did. So this is not the angry mob that the defense is trying to portray. These are brave citizens who stood up to the police at their own peril to say, not in our name, Will you snuff the life out of this man?
And Paul, as you watch witness after witness get on the stand in this trial over the last 3 days and talk about the own their own guilt and what they feel about not intervening somehow, they should let that go. I know it's hard. What could they have done? But my goodness, even the young woman who filmed the video said she felt guilt. Well, her video is why we saw it. It's why we know about this terrible, terrible death of George Floyd. But what exactly is the prosecution going for here? What is their push? And are they executing and carrying out prosecuting a good case here? And on the other hand, how is the defense team handling this? What do they do with a video that we all saw with our own eyes?
So, Willie, every prosecution witness is to establish either that Mr. Chauvin used unreasonable and excessive force, and that it was Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck that killed Mr. Floyd, and not the drug overdose that the prosecutor claimed. So every witness has to establish one of those points. So yesterday we saw Christopher Martin, the clerk, let the jury know that George Floyd was under the influence of drugs during the time of his fatal encounter with the cops. The prosecutors know that the defense lawyers will make a big deal about that. So the prosecutors want to be the first people to let the jury know that, so it doesn't look like they're trying to hide something. But then the video shows Mr. Floyd coherent, in control. He doesn't look like someone who's about to OD on meth. So again, that helps the prosecutor make the point about the actual cause of Mr. Floyd's death. Defense, they're not doing a great job, but frankly, Willie, they don't have a lot to work with. The prosecutor evidence is overwhelming.
We'll be watching the trial closely right here on MSNBC all day. It's really worth taking the time from what you're doing to see what is being said in court and the case that's being laid out here. A lot of different storylines at play that are so important and represent the struggles that we face here in America today. Paul Butler, thank you so much. We appreciate your coming on this morning. As Congress debates what to do about gun violence, new polling shows overwhelming support for certain reforms. According to a new Politico Morning Consult poll, 85% of registered voters support background checks on all gun sales, compared to 11% who oppose. Think of that right there. When it comes to background checks at gun shows and private sales, 79% support that reform, while 13% are against it. And 64% say they support a ban on assault-style weapons, while 27% oppose. Jonathan Lemire, this is one of those issues that, again, there is a party that appears to be behind the trends in America in terms of what people want and in terms of the data. I call it data, but it's daily deaths, mass shootings on a daily basis in this country.
It's 85% is an extraordinary number, Mika. Americans don't agree on anything at that kind of level, at 85%. And this is certainly something that the White House and Democrats are keenly aware of, that especially now in the wake of these two mass shootings, during the pandemic year, they were not as often in the headlines, of course, because people just weren't out and about as much. They sort of moved to the forefront of the national consciousness again. And certainly, there seems to be some real public support here for at least some sort of reforms, these background checks, as you said, perhaps a ban on assault-style weapons. But this also is a moment, Democrats feel like, where the National Rifle Association, the NRA, which has been such a potent force for so long and was by far the biggest obstacle to any sort of gun legislation, they're pretty diminished. They've had real financial trouble, scandals in the leadership, that they're not quite the sort of mammoth force they've been in the past. But at least to this point, most Republicans still seem to oppose these any sort of gun control measures. Now, we've heard Senator Murphy from Connecticut, who's a passionate advocate about this. He represented the school there in Sandy Hook. He says he believes there are some Republican votes that could be had for measures like this. That's what we'll see in the weeks ahead. We know, as we'll get to in a moment, I know the Biden White House's next push is infrastructure, but guns are still on their radar. That's going to be something they move to the forefront at some point. They've actually received some criticism from gun control advocates for not being quick enough on this. In fact, I asked White House Press Secretary Psaki about this earlier this week. She says that we should look for some executive orders in the coming weeks, but those will be small measures. They obviously need to go to Congress for anything substantial.
And another mass shooting to report. Just last night, officials say four people, including a child, were killed at a business complex in Orange, California last night. Two others listed in critical condition, including a fifth victim, the suspect as well, who suffered a gunshot wound, though unclear how. Police now are working to determine a motive. They say the investigation would include multiple agencies. Joining us now by phone, NBC News correspondent Steve Patterson. Steve, good morning. What else do we know?
Hey, good morning, Willie. Yeah, I'm just arriving here in Orange. This is just to give people a frame of reference, about 30 miles southeast of L.A., 6 miles from Disneyland. We know that fifth victim, a woman in the hospital in critical condition. We know the shooter is in the hospital as well, suffered a gunshot wound. We don't know if that was self-inflicted. Police not saying that. They arrived on scene about 5:30. When the first shots were heard, police say when they arrived on scene, the shooting was still going. They arrived to find several victims as they entered that business complex. Imagine the most generic suburban business complex you can think of. Several businesses clustered, nestled in between an apartment complex and some other businesses as well. Police say, you know, they engaged the suspect. This is an officer involved shooting. We don't know to what level there was an exchange of gunfire, but from all accounts, it sounds like police were under fire as well. Businesses, you know, in that complex, there's property rental management companies, insurance agencies, things that you might imagine in a generic complex like that. We know, again, a child was involved and killed in this shooting. But again, it's so early in this investigation, police not saying what, if any, there was a relationship with the shooter, the shooter's identity, the victim's identity. All of this will be obviously per the course of the investigation as well. Meanwhile, you know, state city leaders chiming in. Gavin Newsom, the governor here, calling this horrifying and heartbreaking. Several area representatives as well, lending their condolences. But obviously, this has to reach a certain level in the investigation before police can move forward to find out and determine what happened here with another shooting. It seems week after week after week, we keep experiencing these mass shootings. Obviously, in California, the gun laws, you know, are relatively strict when it comes, obviously, with the rest of the country and especially some of the western states that neighbor this area. But it seemed not to matter here in this shooting as well.
Yeah, as you're reporting, a child among the four people killed in a shooting in Orange, California. Steve Patterson, we'll let you get out and continue reporting on this story. Thanks for being with us. Mika, as Steve said, last week it was a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado. 2 weeks ago, it was a series of spas in Georgia, in and around Atlanta. And last night, it was Orange, California, a child among four killed there.
And in between those first two shootings, there was a shooting every day. Every day, a mass shooting, as it qualifies as a mass shooting, has happened. I mean, this is beyond an epidemic. It's a reality that the American people would like some constraints on. And yet in Washington, nothing. Still ahead on Morning Joe, President Biden unveils his sweeping new infrastructure plan. We're taking a look at what exactly is included in the package. Plus, after 4 years of pushing off concerns about the federal deficit, Republican lawmakers seem to have rediscovered the issue now that Biden is president. The Washington Examiner's David Drucker joins us with that new reporting. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood which means affordable, high-quality, basic healthcare for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the healthcare we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves healthcare. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
I'm proposing a plan for the nation that rewards work, not just rewards wealth. It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago. In fact, it's the largest American jobs investment since World War II. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done. I'm convinced that if we act now, in 50 years, people are going to look back and say, this was the moment that America won the future. It's a basic question. Can democracies still deliver for their people? Can they get a majority? I believe we can. I believe we must.
My advice to the administration is, if you want to do an infrastructure bill, let's do an infrastructure bill. Let's don't turn it into a massive effort to raise taxes on businesses and individuals.
President Joe Biden yesterday unveiling his $2 trillion infrastructure plan and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell criticizing it. Jonathan Lemire, I think the president will probably be able to get his plan, but the question is how to get more Republican support, because all of a sudden they do care about spending. And, oh, tax increases. It's not a good thing for them.
Right. The concerns about spending began on the evening of January 20th after being ignored the previous 4 years by Republicans. Yesterday was long awaited, the unveiling of President Biden's infrastructure deal. I was part of that trip yesterday to Pittsburgh where he outlined it, and it has just played. I mean, this is a big package. It is lots of money, of course, for roads, highways, train service. But more than that, it's about broadband. It's about, replacing lead pipes in cities like Flint, Michigan, where people have had to drink contaminated water for so long. There's going to be a second part of this deal announced in a few weeks. It's going to be more about people, as the White House is framing it, childcare, healthcare, and so on. This one is a little more of the bricks and mortar, which is a popular issue. Again, it polls well, and we certainly know that Republicans support the idea of infrastructure improvements. They don't support so much is how they're going to pay for them. The White House is indeed is increasing taxes. They're proposing increasing taxes on corporations. They're unwinding some of President Trump's tax cut there in order to pay for this. And they're already facing staunch opposition from Republicans and a little bit from progressives on the left who say this deal, even if it tops over, but $3 trillion doesn't quite go far enough. But this is clearly their priority. And if needed, the White House will go it alone with just Democrats and perhaps play the reconciliation card again. But they don't want to do that just yet. There is going to be, aides tell me, a real effort here to engage Republicans. This is going to be a slower timeline than the COVID relief bill, which from start to finish was like 2 months. They're willing to let this play out for a while. They just want to have it done by the end of the summer. So there are going to be open suggestions. They're going to work with Republicans. But yes, odds are against any Republican will ever vote yes for a measure that increases taxes even a little.
Let's look through what's really inside this massive plan. Joined by former Treasury official, Morning Joe economic analyst Steve Rattner, also member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay, and senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, David Drucker. Good morning to you all. Steve, let's begin with your chart. So we're talking about $2.25 trillion after $1.9 trillion still rolling off the presses for COVID relief. What exactly, as you look through it, is in this plan?
Well, Willie, as you say, it's a very, very big plan, bigger than the last plan. And actually, people call it an infrastructure bill, but as Jonathan Lemire alluded, it's a lot more than that. In fact, infrastructure is only about 42% of the total package, as you can see on the chart. All the blue stuff on your right is infrastructure related. We did rough justice here. There's not full detail on all these plans. So transportation, of course, we all talk about highways and bridges is at the top of the list, as well as things like water that Jonathan also mentioned. But then in addition to that 42%, you have another 20% or so that is going into what I'll call other investment, things like R&D, things like manufacturing of critical supplies that we need for pandemics, things like semiconductors, which are in short supply. But then there's a whole nother piece, another almost 40%, which is really other stuff. And it's not even clear entirely what some of that other stuff is. There's $400 billion for home caregiving for elderly and disabled people. There's a substantial amount of money in there for fixing up housing, which is kind of an investment, but also kind of fixing up housing. And so it's a whole bunch of different kinds of things, a bit like the COVID bill, was sort of a COVID bill, but also did a lot of other things. But if you think about the president's points, he's right. We do need to do something. And the next chart will show you quite why we need to do something, which is a look at what's been happening to the federal budget. The line that's going up, the orangish line that's going up, are the costs of all of our Social Security and Medicare and other what we call mandatory or entitlements programs. Those rising costs have pushed down what we spend on pretty much everything else. The red line is pretty much everything else. It's all of our discretionary spending, everything from military to HUD to transportation to education and so forth. And even within that category, the lighter colored line is what we spend on what, again, we would call investment, infrastructure, and some of the other things I was talking about. And that's been pushed down even further because of the pressing immediate needs that we've had to spend money. And so the result of which is anything related to investment has been declining substantially as a share of our federal budget for decades and decades, which is why we're in this position of having to do something to fix it up. Now, we have to recognize that the Biden vision is for much more bigger and much more robust government, and really fundamentally changing the size and role of government in the American system. The blue line shows what government has been spending over the decades, and as you can see, it's bounced around between about 20 and 25%, the 25% being during the GFC, and then it came back down closer to its historic level of around 20%. COVID jumped that up, not surprisingly. You can see the jump for COVID, and it does start to come down. But the dark blue line shows where Biden would, in effect, have it stop coming down at around 25% of GDP. So, in effect, government would go from a historical average of being about 20% of GDP to 25% of GDP. And that is a huge change in the size and role of government. The orange line is taxes, and you can see those have bounced around also between about 15 and 20%. But even with the tax proposal that Biden unveiled yesterday, taxes jump up a bit, but not enough to close the gap. And so the difference between that dark blue line and that dark red line are the deficits over $1 trillion, pretty much, not just pretty much, completely as far as the eye can see. So it is a big, complicated package. As Jonathan said, it is going to be a tough, much tougher fight in Congress over all these different provisions, almost certainly ending up in reconciliation. But even the Democrats are going to have a lot of questions and changes that they want to make in this plan.
Yeah, David Drucker, Mitch McConnell is calling this plan, as he did with the COVID relief plan, a Trojan horse, saying it's not really just about infrastructure. It's not just about roads and bridges and all the things Steve walked us through there. It's about getting progressive agenda through under the Biden administration. He's rejecting deficit spending. He's rejecting raising taxes on corporations. All these things now that they weren't terribly concerned about under Donald Trump now have come back to the forefront for Republicans. Can you see a universe, a negotiation, a version of this plan that could get some Republicans on board?
Well, I don't know if I can see our universe with Republicans getting on board, but I suppose there might be some somewhere. Look, I think part of this is understandable. Republicans in Congress, including Mitch McConnell, were always uncomfortable with President Trump's embrace of deficit spending. President Trump, I think to his credit, realized that by the time he was running for office, there really wasn't a constituency for concern about debts and deficits. Everybody says they're concerned because everybody believes in theory that we're supposed to balance our books and not overspend. That's how we all have to run our households, at least if we do it right. But when you go to the American people and say, well, that means we need to cut this or we need to cut that or we need to pare back on this or we need to pare back on that, everybody just says no, 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 and no. And the president, for all of his, you know, political problems during his first term, that was never one of them. So with President Biden in office, who this plan makes perfect sense for him. He was never a centrist. He only appears moderate by the backdrop of our current politics. This is an old school liberal democratic bill that believes in the power of government to change people's lives. And it's natural that he would go forward with something like this, a struggling economy or not. And now it gives Republicans an opportunity to sort of rediscover their deficit hawk roots, because their voters who were very inclined to go along with President Trump and whatever he wanted to do are now happy to see Republicans in Congress oppose a Democratic president. I think the key here is where Republicans were not able to make a case with voters regarding the American Rescue Plan, that COVID relief bill that also included a number of other liberal priorities beyond COVID relief. Can they successfully win the argument with voters this time around with the American Jobs Plan, as Biden is calling it? Very interesting thing is that in 2017 and then after into 2018, Republicans were never able to win the argument writ large when it came to their $1.3 trillion tax overhaul, some of which actually socked it to wealthy voters. Talk to wealthy voters in states like New York and California, and they will complain about the tax benefits that they lost under Trump's tax bill. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, Democrats were very successful in presenting that bill as a giveaway to the rich that didn't help the middle class or people on the lower ends of the economic ladder. And so my big question is, Republicans may have a good case to make here, potentially, given there are climate provisions in this bill that go beyond infrastructure and things that people may have some issues with, but can they win the argument in the court of public opinion? And that still really remains to be seen. They have not won a tax argument in the court of public opinion in quite a few years.
Margay, tell us the concept of this bill as it pertains to progressives and what they were hoping for.
So just to pull back a little bit, I think, you know, we've really been in a time of austerity in this country in terms of infrastructure investment for decades now. So it has not been since the 1960s or earlier that we've really seen the level of investment that the president is talking about. And so I think what is being presented as progressive, you know, either because there are Republicans who want to paint it that way or because there are people on the far left and in the Democratic Party for whom that is advantageous, I think in many ways is actually these are investments that the American people want and voted for when they voted for Joe Biden. Anybody who has been to a city like Flint, Michigan and thought twice about drinking the water, let alone lived there and endured that crisis. Anybody who has been living across southern states, many of them, by the way, are Republican-led states, and had to worry about their drinking water, their sanitation. They have a sewage crisis across the South. And anybody who has been on a stalled subway train, right? And New York City's economy is a massive contributor to the nation's economy and the GDP as a whole, knows that we are overdue in investing in this infrastructure. So I think actually it's the Democrats who really need to sell this to the American people in the same way that FDR was able to do all those years ago as a rescue plan. For a country that has invested in itself very little. We've invested in foreign wars, and we've invested in tax cuts for the wealthy and for corporations. And the middle class and the infrastructure that fuels the middle class, from schools, again, to subways and sanitation infrastructure, has been left behind. So this is decades in the making. We have a lot of catching up to do.
No question about it. And Mika, on the question of whether or not Republicans will get on board, Mark Short, the longtime advisor to Mike Pence, who worked in the White House, has already started an organization to defeat this, looking to raise tens of millions of dollars right. among conservative donors to defeat the plan. And Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, knows where this is headed. He's already exploring the idea with the parliamentarian in the Senate to push this through again with reconciliation, just as they did with the COVID relief bill, knowing full well it's unlikely he'll get a single Republican on board.
There you go. Mara Gay, David Drucker, and Steve Rattner, thank you all very much for being on the show this morning. And coming up, a look at the state of world affairs for an administration that has so much work to do here at home. We'll be right back.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Joining us now, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction, Richard Haass. Richard, we're looking at President Biden's foreign policy with everything that he has on his plate here at home amidst a pandemic. My question to you are, what are the top priorities? And I'll sort of inject your question with, and why not so much on Russia?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right, Mika, in how you set it up. This is an administration that gets up in the morning and is thinking much more domestically about COVID, about economic recovery. You just did the long piece on infrastructure. If Joe Biden's presidency were to end today, it would be seen as a transformational attempt, something we haven't seen on the scale that we're seeing since, say, Lyndon Johnson. This is where the energy so far is in the administration. On foreign policy, probably one or two things stand out. One is a singling out of China, that this is the great strategic competitor and challenge of our time, an economic competitor, an ideological competitor, a strategic competitor. And that's we saw that voiced when the two sides recently got together in Alaska. And the question that's out there is, what is the administration marshal to back it up? What are they prepared to do mm-hmm. militarily? Where can they bring allies along? Are they, for example, going to reenter Asian trade agreements, which would normally be an important part of the strategy? You mentioned Russia. This is an interesting yeah. case. You had the first thing the administration did was sign the nuclear arms control agreement with Russia. That was a priority. But that was really the last positive thing. What we've seen since then is all sorts of disagreements over Mr. Navalny, disagreements about a growing problem in Ukraine. This is disagreements over cyberspace and Russian behavior there. This is a relationship that has very little upside and is really a source of friction or worse.
Well, and I wonder, hasn't the relationship been, just from what we know, damaged or mishandled over the past 4 years? Isn't there a significant amount of work to be done with Russia to reestablish what should be the dynamic?
I think we could reestablish certain types of communications lines, but I don't think we should delude ourselves that even if we do it, even if we basically said we're gonna try to make this a quote unquote more normal relationship and meet with Russian officials from Putin on down, Lavrov and others, I think we have to accept the fact that when Mr. Putin gets up in the morning, he sees the Biden administration as a direct threat. Their emphasis on mm-hmm. democracy, on the rule of law, is exactly what he doesn't want to hear. He sees it as a threat to his rule. He sees it as a threat to Russia. Their opposition to the pipeline of Russian gas that would go to Western Europe. So again, I don't think there's many areas where the United States and Russia overlap, even if we were to establish a more normal or regular relationship. Because there's sometimes in foreign policy you see opportunity and there's upside. And other times in foreign policy, as in life, your real goal is to avoid downsides, to avoid real crises and problems. My guess is that U.S. policy towards Russia now largely falls into that latter category.
Richard, we are 1 month from today, the deadline, May 1st, to withdraw troops from Afghanistan as part of that deal between the Trump administration and the Taliban. President Biden has signaled that that's unlikely to happen, that we'll blow past that deadline as we approach 20 years coming up in October of United States presence in Afghanistan. So what is the future of America in that country, and how long will troops be there?
Willie, you're right. This might be the most pressing foreign policy challenge the administration sees. It's one they're agonizing over. They want to get out. On the other hand, they're obviously unsettled by the likelihood that if they were to get out, it's a question more of when than if the government falls. A Taliban takeover would be terrible on human terms for the women and girls and really all the citizens of Afghanistan. It also would mean that once again, Afghanistan would likely become a venue for global terrorism, as it was 2 decades ago in the run-up to 9/11. So, as you say, they will delay meeting the May 1 deadline. But I got to be honest with you. I think there's no chance of peace. I think these negotiations are ultimately going to come up empty. No chance of building a coalition government. No chance of a military victory over the Taliban. So the tough bullet for the administration to bite on or swallow, whatever metaphor you want to use, is going to be, are we prepared to stay at a low level, a couple of thousand troops with another 8,000 allies to stay indefinitely? And that's the word, indefinitely, in the interest of avoiding the collapse of the Afghan government. Again, to prevent something, to prevent the fiasco, prevent the emergence of a new terrorism venue. We can't deliver good things. We can't avoid bad things. Is that enough of a return on our foreign policy investment? Or will the pressure become so large to bring the troops back home and just wash our hands of it that we leave, which would be probably short-term popular, but I fear would be middle-term and long-term wildly unpopular? That's the dilemma the administration is facing.
All right, Richard Haass, thank you very, very much. And coming up later in the show, we're going to talk to David Ignatius and Julia Yaffe about the Alexei Navalny situation. Coming up, amid calls for an economic boycott of Georgia-based companies, Governor Brian Kemp comes out in defense of the state's newly signed election law, claiming that it expands voting access. We'll take a look at that argument ahead on Morning Joe.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.